So bad actors in the world of financial crime still depend largely on cash and money laundering through banks. But illicit crypto activity is gaining ground. Some say more than $50 billion last year alone.
Yeah, there's always this problem for us to understand the scale and how big is the phenomenon. And it all trickles down to anonymity, how much anonymity you have behind any transaction to hide their identity. My name is Shadi Khoury. I'm Assistant General Counsel and Division Chief of the Financial Integrity Group here at the Legal Department of the IMF.
El Khoury has been tracking criminal activity in the traditional financial system for years, but the introduction of virtual currencies has made a tough job harder.
Today in the crypto world, it's more difficult to know because they think it's anonymous, although there's some efforts to make it less anonymous. But second, it's because it brings profits. So, you know, if you invest in Bitcoin and suddenly the Bitcoin price goes up, that generates more profit for your criminal enterprise.
Shadi El Khoury writes about his experience fighting tech-fueled crime in the September edition of Finance and Development magazine. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
So we hear a lot about financial crime. It's nothing new. And I think most of us actually believe that if we can avoid the scammers, we'll be okay. But your perspective is much broader than that. So to what extent are these crimes a risk to the global economy?
So financial crime has been there historically for a very long time. I think about corruption, tax evasion, organized crimes and drug trafficking, and even environmental crimes, arms trafficking. So there's a long list of financial crime, and they always have negative repercussions on the economies and financial stability of our members, but also globally on the integrity of the international financial sector. Now, I think from the perspective of the IMF, we've been focusing for the last two decades on the laundering of proceeds of crimes or money laundering. And it's a concept that evolved this decade. And recently in the 70s, where globally all the countries went ahead and criminalized the concept. And the beauty of it is that you're not only focusing on the criminal who committed the original crime for financial gain, but also on those persons or enterprises that helped the laundering of proceeds independently from the original crime. An example, if you have a drug trafficker on one side of the border, they produce millions and billions, someone else is helping them conceal and hide those proceeds and harboring them from prosecution and confiscation. And they're at their disposal to grow and make their crime more profitable and more global. And when countries went ahead and criminalized that act, it became more like global effort on not only fighting the crime itself, financial crime, but also following the money and ensuring that the crime is not profitable and countries are proactive into tracing and confiscating the money. Mm. Now, of course, globally, countries have put those rules on the books, and they were very good into standardizing the concept globally. But I think the challenge we've been facing in the last decade is how do you achieve concrete outcomes and how do you protect the economies? And we have a long way into improving tackling the crime by convicting criminals, by confiscating their assets, by working across the borders on the movement of money and ensuring that the economies are safe and the institutions are protected and the rule of law is prevailing. And that drills down to the trust of people in their governments and ensuring that, you know, government are tackling those crimes and there is a social contract between them that criminals are not benefiting from the economy, but also affecting lives and livelihood.
So it's one thing for criminals to find ways of illicitly moving large amounts of cash around. But what happens when you introduce things like virtual currencies, crypto and the like? Is that making things worse?
Absolutely. Think about it as a criminal having to launder. We're talking about big macro trends, and right. you're producing hundreds of millions, even billions. Whether you're a corrupt official embezzling the state or some expenditure on the procurement, or you're evading tax by a multinational, or so it's a big scale. So mm-hmm. the question is, how do you hide the money, and how do you make it efficiently to harbor yourself from prosecution and law enforcement? And I think traditionally we've seen that, you know, there was studies showing that the curse of cash, and even Rogoff arguing that most of the high denomination cash is held by criminals. But of course, beyond the cash, you have the traditional techniques of you put it in the real estate, and or you put it in the banks, but then banks became more diligent into knowing the customers and informing the authorities or reporting suspicious transactions. Yeah. So as a criminal, of course, you want to diversify, and the technology is coming to basically supercharge or giving them more opportunity on two levels. One, the technology is allowing them to commit more crimes. And like, for instance, AI could be used to commit more fraud and fake IDs and so on. But also you have crypto, for instance, that is allowing them to invest more of their ill-gotten proceeds in crypto assets and moving them faster across the border. Right. So suddenly the technology is allowing criminals to find faster and more anonymous ways to move the money across the border. Of course, they're still relying on cash, banks, real estate, precious metals and stones, and so on. But they have those other options available for now. And of course, they will misuse them and grow their empires using the new technology.
So in this piece that you've written for Finance and Development magazine, you describe, or you talk about this huge crypto seizure. What is the significance of that bust? And I mean, what does it tell us about the scale of this problem?
Yeah, so as a background, the U.S. seized around $220 million, all laundered through crypto. And it was the biggest bust or seizure, confiscated amounts here in the U.S. Of course, the criminals use new technology to do that fraud, and they use crypto as a mean to launder and hide the money. In parallel, the law enforcement also were relying on technology and machine learning to follow right. that money and be able to connect the dots across the border and seize the amounts. So there's here use of technology on both sides, and the question, who will prevail on the medium term? Now, stepping back, of course, there are some estimates that around $50 billion are laundered in the crypto market, and the crypto market is growing very fast. Again, put it in a big picture, it's still not equivalent to what is being laundered in the banks or real estate or cash or trade-based money laundering across the border by misinvoicing or barters. There's thousands of ways of doing it. But it's growing very fast, and that's where we have to be ahead of the game and ask governments to, like they've asked banks in the past, to identify their customers and report suspicious transactions. Those who are involved in selling crypto, we call them virtual asset service providers, have also to be regulated, and they have to identify their customers, and if they see something suspicious, they have to report it. I think one takeaway is that there is this race on the use of technology between criminals and governments, and we're seeing kind of criminals using it more efficiently. So the argument is that government have to step up, rely more on technology and talent and data science to tackle the issue. But the other aspect is that we're seeing the dynamic in the financial sector also shifting when virtual assets is being more frequently used than the traditional way of banks or non-banks financial institutions. So that's also require continue regulating the crypto assets market and ensuring that it's not used for criminal purposes.
So I think it gets confusing trying to understand the differences between these virtual currencies. Mm-hmm. So what is the difference between like a cryptocurrency and a stablecoin or a central bank digital currency or CBDC in terms of oversight or the lack thereof?
Yeah, so I'll look at it more from like criminal perspective, but let me define the concept. So the commonality between Bitcoin and stablecoin or crypto asset and stablecoin is that both are issued by private entities. So the difference between the two is that they're both could be accessed by criminal and used for criminal purposes. The only difference we're seeing from is that Bitcoin or crypto assets are often used for investment, while stablecoin is now being used more often as a payment system, which allow the money, the capital to move. Now, to be able to mitigate the risk in those two, you have to ask the private entities that are selling them to the customers or opening wallets to customers to continue to be diligent, know you who you're dealing with. And if you see something suspicious on the account, meaning the transaction are not justified by the profile of the customer, report them to law enforcement. Now, the central bank digital currency is a bit different in the sense that central banks are issuing them in wallets. And the question there is about the anonymity and possibility of traceability. So, meaning when the central bank will design that CBDC, how in the design they will ensure that there are some financial integrity consideration, meaning they're not completely anonymous. When customers get hold of them, there is a way to know when they are misused, who is using them, and for what purpose, and be able to trace and seize if they are illegal purposes. And that's where we're focusing now on how much anonymity is in the design of that CBDC and how you could ensure that when they will be used by the mass, you could still continue investigating when they are criminal misuse while preventing the, you know, keeping the privacy of individuals when they use them for legal purposes. And globally, we're seeing some central bank are more diligent into designing those financial integrity considerations, some are not. And we're hoping that globally, while issuing those central bank digital currency, they could ensure that there's a mass use for legitimate purposes, but there's a way of tracing and busting the illegal money invested there. And there was a recent case in China, I think, where they criminals misused the CBDC and the authorities were able to know who used them and tackle it.
Wow, that's impressive. So in terms of cross-border transactions, there is in place and has been for many years is a pretty rigorous process. I mean, many would argue that it's inefficient, but nonetheless, there are rules and regulations to guard against money laundering and the financing of terrorism. Are these virtual currency transactions exempt from that process?
Yes and no. So take the example of bank-to-bank transaction, where typically most, I would say, the transaction goes through SWIFT. Basically, you go today and to your bank, they know who you are, you ask to transfer an amount to a different country B, and they know it's going from the US to that country B through SWIFT, and it's traceable. They know that who's the sender, who's the recipient, and the chain. Even if you spend some time hiding it more and layering it, every transaction through banks would follow the same process and you could follow the chain. Of course, it takes time for law enforcement to figure it out and coordinate, but at least it's traceable. It might take you years, but at the end of the day, you might find it someplace and be able to seize and recover.
There is like a paper trail of some kind.
Paper trail, banks have to keep the records for 5-10 years and it's required by law. And if they don't, they are kind of sanctioned. So now you have in parallel the service providers who are, we call them VASPs, virtual asset service providers, and they are coming and they're offering their clients virtual assets. And you will have a wallet and you could do it easily, faster on your phone. You don't have to go to a branch. But the question today, the key question is, are you identifying those clients that are purchasing the cryptocurrency, whether it's Bitcoin or others? And when the money moves, is there any traceability? And that's where the global effort is focusing. And there are requirements at the international level, but we're falling short into countries licensing those virtual asset service providers, ensuring that their owners are do not have any criminal background. But then later on, they are doing the customer due diligence and the requirements from an anti-money laundering perspective, and are capable of ensuring that the money movement is traceable until its end destination. And we're seeing also the virtual asset service providers are very smart in playing arbitrage globally. Like when countries becoming stricter on the regulation, they move to less strict country and they continue their operation. I think probably we will get there. Like the concept of shell banks in the past was more or less the same. But the government have to speed up and license them properly and supervise them properly and ensure that they are imposing those requirements. But in the meantime, I think there'll be a lot of scandals before we get to it. And more we will see those scandals and misuse of virtual assets, more government will realize that it's important to tackle them.
And you just mentioned shell companies. So related to that, non-banks are becoming more and more important in our economies. What kind of scrutiny do they fall under when it comes to cross-border transactions where a lot of this criminal activity takes place?
Yeah, and that's a challenging area. I mean, we recognize that most of the transactions are still going through banks, but there are many, many categories. I'll try to simplify the term. So you have non-banks financial institutions. Take a brokerage firm. They could do transactions across the border. You have sometimes insurance companies. They could do the same. And then you have the crypto assets now and virtual asset service providers. But beyond that, we're seeing also the growth of non-financial actors. Take casinos. And, you have casinos that operating across two countries, and they could also send value system. Beyond that, you have the informal operators of you send me goods, I send you goods, but we settle and there is misinvoicing in the process and there's no movement of money through the banking sector. And also growing, and it could be barter agreements and movement. So the question for the AML community is, how do you keep pace of all the movement of capital to ensure that criminals are not using the next one? As long as you close the first, they move to the next and next. And that's the challenge we're facing. I would argue it's not limited to banks and non-banks financial institutions and virtual assets, but also you have to tackle the informality of moving cash, moving through trade, moving through also what we've seen globally, hawaladar, which they exist, they connect, they move through value transfer systems. Mm. Now, the global community again agreed that all the loopholes should be closed and all those private sector entities should be regulated and should be saying something when they see something suspicious. But the reality is that we're still seeing at the national level a lot of loopholes for criminals to go through.
So there are many pieces to this puzzle. And as a lawyer working here at the fund, a financial institution concerned with essentially, global financial stability, how closely do you and your colleagues in the legal department work with economists to deal with these issues?
Yeah, so by background, I'm a lawyer, studied finance, and I work on financial intelligence, which is a powerful tool on tracing that money. But I'm lucky, I have many other colleagues who are economists in the institution, financial sector experts, and data analysts, and so on. And more I work on this area, more I feel like you have to have this diverse background of colleagues thinking around what's happening globally, and are we... We cooperate with another organization, the Financial Action Task Force. They set up the standard and we have this dialogue on whether it's fit for purpose or it should evolve faster. But I think from the fund perspective, we're monitoring things globally, but at the membership, 191 member. And then when we see issues that are affecting the macroeconomic financial stability, we cooperate with the economists to raise them, whether it's in the purpose of the bilateral surveillance, the macro health check on an annual basis, or in the context of a program where countries have to push them through domestic reform, or we provide technical assistance. And we're trying to be more nimble on understanding not only global risks, which are moving fast, like you have said, with the new technology, growth of new technology, You have platforms shifting, payment systems changing, global fragmentation issues, but also at the country-by-country level and to telling them what is the key challenges they're facing. It might be in country A, corruption, in a country B, drug trafficking and organized crime, or tax evasion in the third, or offshore center where all the proceeds are going through. So those dynamics, we're trying to understand them, identify them. I would argue that the standards is evolving, the recognized standards of the Financial Action Task Force is evolving fast and is catching up on the new technology and so on. But of course, there are issues where you're still waiting for consensus around. For instance, the issue of focusing more on cross-border, it's coming up, but not enough. Mm-hmm. The issue, for instance, of trade-based money laundering, how you could move amounts through goods and services and over-invoice or under-invoice, there's no consensus around. I would argue that there are certain things they could tackle, but I think they're fit for purpose overall. The question is more at the government level, where often they try to focus on the crimes happening on their street and security, but not necessarily on the movement of illegal capital across the borders. And that's where we're trying to bring the implications on the economy and highlight that even if sums of millions and billions are moving from country A to your economy, and maybe at the short term beneficial for your banks and the broader real estate or the broader economy, it's being harbored there for criminal across the border, and it will have indirect effects one day or the other because they're feeding on it and creating more violence and crime at the country of origin. And although it's not creating shock for your economy, you have to tackle it a certain way or the other by facing those global challenges and finding global solutions and all countries being more effective in tackling crimes across the border and the laundering and the proceeds. So that's, I think, the difficulty of measuring to what extent it affects macroeconomic and financial stability, convincing our economist colleagues into looking not only at the numbers, but the dynamics of those crimes and how they're affecting domestic and cross-border issues, and keep the pace on ensuring governments are using also technology, talent, data scientists like criminal are doing, and just being more aggressive in tackling financial crime.
Chadi El-Khoury, Assistant Legal Counsel in the IMF's Legal Department. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Look for Chadi El-Khoury's article on fighting tech-fueled crime in the September edition of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/F&D. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.